Chapter 8. Attack on the VCI. In the summer of 1966, steps were finally taken in Washington and Saigon to resolve the debate over who should manage the pacification of South Vietnam. At the heart of the problem was the fact that despite the U.S. Army's success against NVA main force units in the Central Highlands, the Vietnamese people were not supporting the GVN to the extent that President Lyndon Johnson could withdraw American forces and leave the Vietnamese to manage the war on their own. On one side of the debate was the Pentagon, recommending a single chain of command under MACV Commander Westmoreland. The reasons were simple enough. The military was providing 90% of pacification resources, a single chain of command was more efficient, and there was danger in having unsupervised civilians in a battle zone. On the other hand, the civilian agencies were afraid that if the military managed pacification, any political settlement calling for the withdrawal of troops would also require civilians under military management, in, for example, refugee programs, to depart from Vietnam along with U.S. soldiers. In 1965, Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge had handed the problem to Ed Lansdale, whom he appointed senior liaison to the Ministry of Revolutionary Development. But Lansdale, a fifth wheel, according to Brickham, was unwanted and ignored and failed to overcome the bureaucratic rivalries in Saigon. By 1966, the problem was back in Washington, where it was determined that pacification was failing as a result of a combination of poor management and the VCI's ability to disrupt revolutionary development. As a way of resolving these interrelated problems, President Johnson summoned his war managers to a conference at Warrenton, Virginia, in January 1966, the result of which was an agreement that a single pacification manager was needed. Once again, this point of view was advanced by the military through its Special Assistant for Counterinsurgency and Special Activities, General William Pierce, who suggested that the MACV commander be put in charge of pacification with a civilian deputy. Although the civilians continued to object, Johnson wanted quick results, the kind only the military could provide, and shortly thereafter he named National Security Council member Robert Comer his special assistant for pacification. Comer was an advocate of military control, whose master plan was to unite all agencies involved in pacification under his personal management and direct them against the VCI. Meanwhile, the Saigon Embassy commissioned a study on the problem of interagency coordination. Begun in July 1966 under Mission Coordinator George Jake Jacobson, the Roles and Mission Study made 81 recommendations, 66 of which were accepted by everyone. Consensus had been achieved, and a major reorganization commenced. Notably, the policy for anti-VCI operations as stated by the Roles and Mission Study was that the police special branch assume primary responsibility for the destruction of the Viet Cong infrastructure. We did claim in Roles and Missions, according to Brickham, the CIA representative on that committee, that the police should have a major civilian role and be the spearhead of the effort, because it was the police over the long haul and in terms of ultimate victory that would have to settle the problem, and that therefore we should not let the military run everything till the end of the war, then let everything fall into chaos when the military was brought out. But in pursuit of total victory, the size and pace of military operations were steadily escalating in 1966, more and more to the exclusion of the concerns of the civilian agencies involved in pacification. For example, the military was more concerned with gathering intelligence on the size and location of enemy combat units than on its political infrastructure. Military agent nets and interrogators zeroed in on this type of information, reflecting what Brickham termed the military mentality, the object of which is to set up a battle. The police mentality, according to Brickham, is to arrest, convict, and send to jail, while the intelligence mentality is to capture, interrogate, and turn in place. Expanding on this theme, Brickham said, "If the military were going into a province, the sector advisor and the sector S2, sector intelligence advisor, would be brought in, do their thing, and come out without ever being aware of the enormous intelligence capability residing in the special police. When, in provinces manned by bright military officers, they did bring in the special police, it was done on an ad hoc basis. Conversely, any time the military took over a civilian operation or activity, 9 times out of 10 it would be a perversion of the civilian capability into a military support arm, And when that happened, we would almost invariably find that the so-called civilian intelligence operation was quickly perverted to provide tactical combat intelligence for U.S. or ARVN forces. This was a tendency which had to be constantly opposed. However, Brigham qualified his opposition to the emphasis on tactical military concerns by noting, "The CIA could not claim exclusive jurisdiction for an attack on the VCI. We would not have wanted to. Special branch wasn't strong enough. It suffered from incompetent leadership and from poor training, even though special branch personnel and leadership were a cut above the regular staffing of the National Police. What was needed was cooperation. But while turf battles between the CIA and the military were obstructing the war effort, the problem was exacerbated when the Vietnamese were factored into the equation." Talk about bureaucratic infighting, Brigham laughed. Well, it was far worse on the Vietnamese side. There was unquestionably contempt held by the ARVN for the National Police. The Vietnamese military had no use for them, and to the extent that the U.S. military may have reflected the ARVN point of view, if there was a joint ARVN-American operation, well, the Special Police would have been systematically cut out of the thing. Into this bureaucratic minefield in August 1966 stepped Robert Comer, packing a mandate from President Johnson and intent upon effecting the military takeover of pacification. Predictably, the civilian agencies recoiled in horror. The State Department cited the political nature of pacification, and neither the Agency for International Development nor the CIA thought the military capable of doing the job. So, under pressure from Ambassador Lodge, who bestowed upon Comer the nickname Blowtorch, President Johnson gave the civilians one last shot. The result was the Office of Civilian Operations, OCO. Formed in October 1966, OCO combined the field operations units of AID, USIS, and CIA, and on this basis was organized into branches for psychological operations, political action, defectors, public safety, refugees, and economic development. Under the director, Wade Lathrum, and his military deputy, General Paul Smith, OCO region directors were assigned to each corps. John Vann from AID in two corps, State Department officer Art Corin in one corps, CIA officer Vince Heyman in four corps, and Robert Mattson in two corps. Ed Lansdale was slated for Mattson's job but turned it down. Given 4 months to show results, the Office of Civil Operations was doomed from the start, but it did prove valuable by forcing the civilian agencies to work together. Faced with the prospect of military control, agency chains of command, extending from Washington to Saigon to the provinces, were wrenched apart and realigned. And even though nothing was achieved in terms of improving pacification, the formation of the Office of Civil Operations spared MACV Commander Westmoreland from having to reorganize the civilian agencies himself. In March 1967, President Johnson was to incorporate OCO within MACV under the Revolutionary Development Support Directorate, managed by General William Knowlton. Announced in May 1967, the Military Assistance Command for Civil Operations and Revolutionary Development, CORDS, was to be the bureaucratic vessel from which Phoenix would be born. During the big reorganization at the end of 1966, Brigham recalled, they were trying to clean up the RD programs and streamline the war effort. So all the field operations, both covert and police special branch, were more or less divorced from the station and put under OCO, which was later called CORDS, in the Revolutionary Development Cadre Division. Lou Lapham came out from Washington to become the new deputy chief of station and chief of the RDC. I moved over from Rocky Stone's jurisdiction to Lapham's jurisdiction and answered to him. Lou was a very quiet, laid-back ex-professor with thick-rimmed glasses. He did not have a paramilitary background. His bag was propaganda and psychological warfare. RDC took over the CIA's covert action programs under its operations branch, RDCO, Brigham explained, while a second branch, RDCP, plans, took over police field operations. That was my shop. I no longer had the title of Chief of Field Operations, but it was the same job with basically the same duties, except we were theoretically working toward a coordinated system. I became chief of RDCP, and we and RDCO moved from the embassy annex to another building called USAID-2. Donahue went home, and a new guy, Renz Hoeksema, came out from Washington and took over that shop. Renz and I had done two tours together in Tehran. He was a hard-driven officer, very smart, one of those Midwest Dutchmen of whom we have several in the agency. Brigham described Hoeksema as ruthless and an expert on self-promotion. During the reorganization, Brigham continued, the station adopted the Special Branch Field Operations organizational structure as a model for coordinating liaison and covert operations. Only instead of using six regions, they used the four core zones. Metaux and Bon Metaux were no longer regional offices. After that, all CIA activities in a region were brought under one officer called the Region Officer in Charge, ROIC. Likewise, province officers in charge followed automatically. The POIC was in charge of all CIA operations, covert and liaison, in a province, Brigham explained. He could have been drawn from liaison or covert operations, depending on who the ROIC thought was the best guy in the province. Incidentally, we did not actually assign POICs right away, because the rivalry and lack of trust between FI and PM people wouldn't allow it. When I talk about coordination problems in Vietnam, the fact is that we could not even coordinate the station programs in province. After the ROICs were named, we set up bases. The engineers went out and built vaults in each of these places and set up the complete multi-channel automatic teleprinter encryptographic system radio communications. From this point on, the line command went from the chief of station to the deputy chief of station for RDC to the ROICs, then to the POICs. Rens Hoeksema and I were no longer supervisors in the chain of command of the field operations. We were now running branches of staff assistants to the chief of RDC outside the station. It made little difference, except the ROICs would occasionally thumb their noses at us, but I didn't object. You couldn't run it any other way. So the major result of the fall 1966 decision was to separate the station and the counterinsurgency effort. That was a result of Stone's attitude toward this. And he was right. It's mixing oil and water. One other significant event occurred at this juncture. The provincial reconnaissance units were offered to me in the fall of 1966, Brigham recalled. It was one of the options discussed at the time of the reorganization. This offer was made to me in terms of John Hart's dissatisfaction with the reputation the CTs had acquired. He wanted to turn the CTs into an intelligence arm for capturing prisoners and documents, and not a paramilitary service. But I didn't want them, Brigham said, mainly because I didn't think we could manage them properly. My foreign intelligence guys were in no way, in terms of experience, able to control or direct PRU teams. Consequently, as of November 1966, the recycled counterterrorists were called Provincial Reconnaissance Units and were thereafter managed by CIA officer William Riddell in Rens Hoeksema's operation shop in Cord's Revolutionary Development Cadre Division. It is commonly agreed that the U.S. military went to Vietnam to fight a conventional war. However, by late 1966, it was clear that gains on the battlefield were transitory and that the war would not be won by seizing pieces of territory. Grudgingly, the military was forced to admit that VCI political power could offset U.S. firepower. Bear in mind, Brigham told me, that the military was only over there from mid-1965, so it took a period of time for this realization to sink in. The exploitation of province national police resources by the U.S. military was sporadic at best up until the fall of 1966, when we made a systematic procedure out of it. Indeed, the process of systematizing the attack against the VCI began in the fall of 1966, when Rocky Stone arranged for Nelson Brigham to brief General Westmoreland on the subject. The impetus for the briefing came from the roles and mission study and the conclusion reached at the 1966 combined campaign plan that increased emphasis will be given to identifying and eliminating the VCI infrastructure and to small unit operations designed specifically to destroy guerrilla forces. These things were all evolving and coming together because of the Office of Civil Operations, Brigham noted. People wanted to know what you meant when you said attack against the VCI. So while preparing for his hour-long briefing of Westmoreland, Brigham wrote a paper aptly titled, Attack Against the Viet Cong Infrastructure. His purpose was to summarize everything that was known about intelligence sources and reaction forces involved in the anti-subversive facet of the war. I don't think Westie had ever heard of the special branch before our briefing, Brigham quipped, or the fact that we had provincial interrogation centers or political order of battle files on VC in the villages and districts. In any event, attack was circulated among the MACV and CIA staffs and was accepted as the definitive statement on the VCI. Written on November 22, 1966, ATTAC is significant for three reasons. First was its definition of the VCI as the VC organizational hierarchy, the management structure, as opposed to guerrillas, troops, and even in many cases VC terrorists. Many, if not most of these categories, guerrillas, troops, and even terrorists, are young people who have been either impressed or seduced into the VC and cannot in any way be considered hardcore communists. Specifically cited in ATTAC as VCI were all party members and front organization officers, as opposed to the rank and file of these front organizations. Thus, all members of a village chapter, all district committee, and all province committee cadre are included, as of course are the higher echelons, region and COSVN. We would also include members of the so-called sapper units. These people are hardened communist troops organized in military formations to carry out sabotage and terrorism of the larger and more dramatic nature. Hotel bombings in Saigon, Longbin ammunition dump, General Walt's residence. These latter are not casual acts of terrorism, but carefully planned and fully organized military operations, commando-type operations. About the word infrastructure, Brigham said during our interview, it may be peculiarly applicable to insurgency due to the animistic conceptual view held by rural people in want of literacy and hygiene, let alone technology. Brigham held the revisionist view that in an insurgency among such people, only 5% of the population is politically active, with 2.5% for the insurgents and 2.5% against them. The rural population is not the driving force. Their attitude, he said, is a pox upon both your houses. Without an infrastructure, Brigham said, there is only a headless body. Destroy the infrastructure, you destroy the insurgency. However, this is not such an easy thing to do, despite any disaffection on the part of the majority of the people. Nor is it exclusively a matter of winning hearts and minds. That only makes it easier to destroy the infrastructure. Brigham viewed the VCI as a criminal conspiracy, a mafia operating under the pretense of political ideology, coercing people through the selective use of terror. The insurgency, in his opinion, attracted people oriented toward violence and, through political fronts, naive individuals. The presence of such marginal characters, he contends, made the attack on the VCI a difficult task. Secondly, ATTAC is significant in that it defines the attack against the VCI in terms of special branch field operations, informants, interrogations, and penetrations, of which interrogations are, by far, the most important source. Informant operations produced information mostly on hamlet and village cadres and guerrillas, while penetrations could produce substantial bodies of infrastructure information, identification of cadre movements and activities, and at times advance information of meetings and conferences. As of September 30, 1966, as stated in ATTAC, there were 137 penetrations of district committees, 93 belonging to Special Branch, 44 to the CIO. Special Branch was then developing 92 more penetrations, and the CIO 61. The action tools in the attack on the VCI were primarily ambushes by the police, PRU or regional forces, and special forces elements, and military search and destroy, hamlet search, or country fair type operations. For these operations, Brigham explains in ATTAC, the police prepare search lists from their files and collect VC defectors and other sources to use as identifiers of VC caught in these cordon and sweep operations. Even though William Colby later testified to Congress that Phoenix was a South Vietnamese police program, Brigham in ATTAC states, a final and not insignificant tool are direct military operations. For example, 175-meter artillery fire was directed on the reported site of a combined conference of COSVN representatives. On the basis of after-action reports, Brigham writes, we are confident that the damage to the infrastructure in terms of key personnel killed is significant. ATTAC also mentions a special task force organized to launch a combined intelligence-police-military assault against the MR4, Saigon, Cholong, Xia Ding Special Zone Committee Headquarters, and Base Area. This is the third significant point raised by ATTAC. Called Cong Tac 4 by its Vietnamese creators, it is the operational model for Phoenix, and as such deserves a detailed explanation. General McChristian writes that Kong TAC-4 evolved concurrently with the joint U.S.-Vietnamese Combined Intelligence Staff from an intensive intelligence program, Project Corral, which he initiated in the spring and early summer of 1966 and directed against MR4. The purpose was to produce intelligence on the identification and location of Viet Cong operating in MR4 and the dissemination of this intelligence to user agencies for apprehension and exploitation of enemy personnel. In September 1966, McChristian met with General Loan to discuss his plans for a combined intelligence staff. The idea was approved in November by Prime Minister Ky, the Vietnamese Joint General Staff, and the U.S. Mission Council. As a result, and as a substitute for Hop TAC, Operation Fairfax was begun in December, using 3 American and 3 ARVN battalions for the purpose of searching out and destroying VC main force units, guerrillas, and infrastructure in the MR4 area. Operation Fairfax and the Combined Intelligence Staff, CIS, were the primary elements of Kong TAC-4. The initial actions of the Combined Intelligence Staff, McChristian writes, were to combine a blacklist of MR4 infrastructure personalities in support of the combined U.S. and Vietnamese military actions in this area. In the process, the Combined Intelligence Staff compiled, by hand, more than 3,000 names, which were stored in a central registry and made available to U.S. and Vietnamese units. Later, the systematic identification and location of VC and the rapid retrieval of these data in usable form was made possible by the use of the automated data processing system located at the Combined Intelligence Center, Vietnam. In fact, the foundation for the Combined Intelligence Staff was laid on the American side in 1964 when CIA Security Chief Robert Gambino created the Combined Security Committee inside Saigon's First Precinct headquarters. Through a secure radio network linking each of Saigon's 9 precincts, the Combined Security Committee coordinated CIA and State Department security officers at the American Embassy with MACV and Vietnamese Military Security Service officers at Tan Chon Nut and with a special branch at National Police Headquarters and alerted them of pending VC attacks. The Combined Security Committee was directed by Colonel Nguyen Nhoc Xin, Chief of Staff of the Saigon Police and the Deputy to the Saigon Police Chief, Lieutenant Colonel Nguyen Van Luan. By mid-1967, the Combined Security Committee's Blue Network covered all of CT-4. For deeper insights into Kong TAC-4, we turn to Tullius Akampora, a U.S. Army counterintelligence officer and Korean War veteran who was detached to the CIA in June 1966 as General Luan's advisor. As an officer on General James Van Fleet's staff in Korea, Akampora had had prior dealings with John Hart, who as station chief in Korea had masqueraded as an army colonel and had interfered in military operations to the extent that General Van Fleet called him an arrogant SOB. The old grudges were carried forward in Saigon to the detriment of Phoenix. "I assisted Hart," Akampora sighed, when we first met in 1986 at Fort Myers. "He called me in and said, 'We're dealing with an enigma, a cobra, General Luan.'" Now, Luan had a Mandarin Dai Viet background, and his father had escaped Diem. Consequently, under Lee, Luan was very powerful, and Hart resented Luan's concentration of power. Although he was not a political animal, Luan was substantial. So Hart took away first his supervision of the Military Security Service, and eventually his oversight of Central Intelligence Organization. But for a while, Luan ran them both, along with the National Police. "When I arrived in Saigon," Akampora continued, "at the national level, the U.S. Embassy, with the agency and MACV, had decided to take over everything in order to change the political climate of Vietnam. Through the CIO, the agency was running all sorts of counter-operations to VC infiltration into political parties, trying to find compatible elements to create a counterforce to take over control from Ky, who is a peacock. This was done by intercepting VC political cadre, surveilling them, then arresting them or moving toward them, then buying them over to your side in order to destroy the integrity of the VC. Akampora qualified this statement by noting, "The VC would always say yes, but they were usually doubles." "It was a dual-level scheme," Akampora went on. "We were faced with a threat of terrorism from sappers, but we also had to stop them at the political level. We stopped them at sapper level with PRU under the Special Operations Group, and at the political level through the CIO, the centerpiece of which was the National Interrogation Center under Special Branch Chief Nguyen Tien. The CIO operated over and above CT-4. It could take whatever it wanted, people or information or whatever, from any of its elements. Its job was to turn around captured VCI and preempt Luan. When it came to CT-4, however, Luan wanted control. Luan said to Hart, "You join us, we won't join you." In effect, Luan told Hart to go screw himself, and so Hart wanted me to assuage Luan to bring him in tow. But this was not to be, for General Luan, a dyed-in-the-wool nationalist, had his own agenda. In fact, the basis for CT-4 derived, on the Vietnamese side, from a counter-subversion program he commissioned in the summer of 1966. The thrust of the program was to prevent VC agents from infiltrating pro-GVN political parties and to prevent sappers from entering Saigon. Called the Phung Hoang Program, it was, according to Akampora, wholly inspired and conducted by the Vietnamese. The man who conceived Phung Hoang at the request of General Luan was the Special Branch Deputy Director, Colonel Dong Vong Minh, a Claude Rains type of character who, according to Akampora, was a stoic who took the path of least resistance. Born on Con Son Island, where his father was a nurse, Minh, at age 18, joined the accounting department of the French Sûreté. During the Ngo regime, he received CIA training overseas and was then appointed chief of the Judicial Police, the only national police branch with the power to arrest. After the coup, Minh became deputy director of the special branch. Insulated behind his desk at Special Branch Headquarters on Va Tan Street, Minh weathered each successive regime by serving his bosses as a professional intelligence officer. Indeed, when I met Minh at his office in 1986, he attributed the fall of Saigon to the many changes of command in Saigon, while North Vietnam had only one leader and one chain of command. That, plus the fact that the Viet Cong had infiltrated every facet of the GVN, a fact Luan also acknowledged when he confessed to Akampora, we're 20% infiltrated, at least. Minh's attack against the VCI was measured, sophisticated, and diametrically opposed to American policy. In contrast with Brigham, Minh viewed the VCI as village-level cadres to be monitored, not killed. As Minh conceived the attack on the VCI, all Vietnamese agencies receiving information on the VCI would forward their reports to the special branch for inclusion in its political order of battle file. The goal was the combination of intelligence, as Minh termed it, Phuoi Hop in Vietnamese. Seeking an appropriate acronym, Minh borrowed the PH from Phuoi and the Ho from Hop and christened the program Phung Hoang, after the mythological Vietnamese bird of conjugal love that appears only in times of peace. In Vietnamese myth, the Phung Hoang bird holds a flute and represents virtue, grace, peace, and concord. Its song includes the five notes of the Vietnamese musical scale, and its feathers include the five basic colors. Before long, however, Phung Hoang was transformed into Phoenix, the mythological bird that perpetually rises from its own ashes. As the Americans drew it, the bird held a blacklist in its claw. In this manifestation, Phoenix is an omnipotent, predatory bird that selectively snatches its prey, a symbol of discord rather than harmony. Nowhere is the gap between American and Vietnamese sensibilities more important than in their interpretations of Phoenix and Phung Hoang, which also represent the struggle between General Luan and John Hart for control over the attack on the VCI. In this contest, Luan scored first when, for legal reasons, Cong Thach 4 was placed under his control. Luan assigned as many as 50 officers to the program from the participating Vietnamese agencies, with Major Nguyen Mao in charge of operations, assisted by Dong Vong Minh. The United States provided 20 MACV counterintelligence officers, each of whom served as a desk officer in a Saigon precinct or outlying district capital. CIA officer Tom Becker supervised the headquarters staff, the Australians assigned their embassy security officer Mike Leslie, and the Koreans provided a representative. Members of CT-4 were not part of any separate unit, but remained identified with their parent agencies and did not have to backchannel to bring resources to bear. Cong Thach 4 came into existence on November 1, 1966, the day Lew Lapham arrived in Saigon to take over the second station, as the Revolutionary Development Cadre Program was sometimes called. Curiously, it was the same day that VC mortars first fell on Saigon. U.S. generals, dozing in reviewing stands only a few blocks away, were oblivious of the fact that the VC were using a nearby church spire as a triangulation point for their fire. From November 1 onward, Tully Akampora managed CT-4 with Major Mao. The program kicked in when Tom Becker, assisted by MACV officers Larry Tracy and John Ford, adopted the standard American police ID kit, replete with Occidental facial features. With their ID kits in hand, CT4 desk officers ventured into the precincts and districts, accompanied by special branch and military security service officers. They screened suspects who had been corralled by military units conducting cordon and search operations, took photographs, put together composites of suspected VCI members, then compiled the results and sent their reports to CT4 headquarters in the National Police Interrogation Center in Saigon, where it was collated, analyzed, and used to compile blacklists of the VCI. They called it police work, Akampora said, because the police had the constitutional responsibility for counter-subversion, but it was paramilitary. In any event, Loan was going to bring it all together, and he did, until Comer came out in February 1967 and was briefed by Mao and Tracy. In a 1986 interview with the author, Tracy agreed that the demise of CT4 came from politicking on the part of the Americans. It was short-lived, he told me, because Comer saw it as a prototype and wanted to make it nationwide before working out the methodology. Comer wanted to use CT4 as a showcase, as part of the combined intelligence staff, but General Luan was reluctant to participate and had to be strong-armed by Comer in February 1967. By April 1967, the combined intelligence staff would have entered more than 6,500 names in its contact database and would be adding 1,200 per month. As the methodology was developed, a search unit consisting of three 49-man field police platoons began accompanying the U.S. and Vietnamese military units conducting cordon and search operations in MR4. With the military providing a shield, the field police checked IDs against blacklists, arrested VCI suspects, and released innocent bystanders. According to General McChristian, from the inception of the combined intelligence staff until 1 November 1967, approximately 500 VC action agents were apprehended in Saigon and environs. The significance of these arrests and the success of the staff cannot be fully measured, but unquestionably contributed to the communist failures in Saigon during the 1968 Tet Offensive. Whether or not Tet was a failure for the VC will be discussed later. But once the CIA had committed itself to the attack on the VCI, it needed to find a way of coordinating its efforts with the other civilian agencies, American and Vietnamese, working independently of each other in the provinces. Considering the number of agencies involved and their antipathy, this was no easy thing to do. To wit, at Nelson Brickham's request, the liaison officer in Xia Ding province, John Turgellian, did a study on the problem of coordination. The count he made, Brickham recalled, was something like 22 separate intelligence agencies and operations in his province alone. It was a Chinese fire drill, and it didn't work because we had so many violently conflicting interests involved in this thing. But while the bureaucratic titans clashed in Saigon, a few military and CIA officers, in remote provinces where battles raged and people died, were trying to cooperate. In the northernmost region, One Corps, the Marines and the CIA had especially good relations, with the Marines supplementing many of the agency's personnel needs and the CIA in turn sharing its intelligence. Because of this reciprocal relationship, a solution to the problem of interagency coordination was developed there, with much of the credit going to Bob Wall, a CIA paramilitary officer in Quang Nai Province. In December 1966, Wall was made deputy to One Corps region officer in charge, Jack Horgan. Wall recalled, when we met in 1987, in the winter of 1966-67, General Lew Walt was the first Marine amphibious commander, and we, the CIA region staff, would cross the river to attend his briefings each morning. Casualties were minimal, and he was the picture of a Marine, taking his briefings quickly, sitting erect at his desk. Within the next 2 months, however, casualties rose from 2 or 3 a day to 90 a day, and yet the VC body count was minimal. Said Wall, Walt went to the picture of abject frustration slumped at his desk, his head in his hands. He needed help. My experience had been as cadre officer in Quang Nai, where I ran the PATS, the PRU, and the census grievance, added Wall. Forbes was the special branch advisor, but there was no coordination between us and the military or AID. There were about 15 separate programs in Quang Nai, and it took me quite a while to realize this was the problem. Then I got transferred to Da Nang, where, as a result of Walt's inability to make contact with the enemy, I personally proposed Phoenix, by name, to establish intelligence close to the people. Based on a British model in Malaya, we called it a DIOCC, a District Intelligence and Operations Coordination Center. Having learned through the Quang Ngai Province Interrogation Center the structure of the VCI in the province, Wall was aware that the VCI operated from the hamlet up, and that to destroy it, the CIA would have to create in the districts what the PICs were doing in the provinces, hence the DIOCC. Walt grabbed it, Wall recalled. He assigned a crackerjack sergeant to make the necessary equipment available, and this sergeant set it up in Bien Dan, just south of Da Nang in Quang Nam province. Then we did two more, in Hunan and Phong Dien districts in Tua Tien province. The Dien Bon DIOCC went into effect in January 1967 and was the model on which Phoenix facilities were later built throughout Vietnam. A prefab building 10 by 40 feet large, it was built by Marines and located in their district compound. On duty inside were Sergeant Fisher and Lieutenant Morse, along with two people from Census Grievance, one from R.D. Kadri, and one from Special Branch. There were two interpreter translators and three clerk typists. Census Grievance supplied desks, typewriters, and a file cabinet. The Marines supplied the wall map and an electric fan. Office supplies came from the CIA's paramilitary officer in Quang Nam province. A radio was used for high-priority traffic, with normal communications going by landline to other districts and 3rd Marine HQ. It was not a sophisticated affair. The purpose of the DIOCC was that of an intelligence clearinghouse to review, collate, and disseminate critical information provided by the various intelligence agencies in the area. But what made it innovative was that dissemination was immediate at the reaction level, whereas the member agencies had previously reported through their own channels to their province headquarters, where the information was lateral to other interested agencies, which then passed it down to the districts. Also, a summary was made at the end of each day. In the Dien Bon DIOCC, the Americans handled the record-keeping, with Lieutenant Morse managing the order of battle reporting and Sergeant Fisher taking care of the VCI files and source control cards. In order to protect agents, each agency identified its own sources by number. Local Marine and ARVN commanders made units available as reaction forces for the DIOCC. More than 100 policemen in Dien Bon were also made available, along with the Provincial Reconnaissance Unit from the province capital in Hoi An. The DIOCC provided guides from Census Grievance, and the police supplied ID kits to the operating units. The Marines screened civilian detainees, CDs, arrested in operations, using informants or special branch officers to check names against the DIOCC's blacklist. When a positive identification was made, they delivered the suspect to the PIC in Hoi An. A Marine detached to the PIC, Warrant Officer Richardson, made a daily run from the PIC to the DIOCC, bringing interrogation reports and other province-generated information. Most CDs were turned over to district police, at which point, the Americans complained, they paid bribes and returned home, there to be arrested again and again. Phoenix, insisted Wall, represented the strategy that could have won the war. The problem was that Phoenix fell outside foreign intelligence, and paramilitary programs are historically trouble for intelligence, so Phoenix never got primary attention. MacVie did not have the mentality to work with the police. The police were not trained to win hearts and minds, and Ministry of Interior Kim, fearing a coup, mistrusted the police and would not assign quality personnel. Phoenix did not work in Vietnam because it was dominated, Wall told me, by the military mentality. They couldn't believe they would lose.